Today is Wednesday, August 30th, 2023. This is part 23 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his name A-L-L-E-N-M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing just fine, thanks.
Great. And thank you again for your reminder yesterday for me to ask you, may we record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much. Alan, yesterday you were walking us through the orchard at Lonely Dell, and I wondered if you could tell us more about the consortium's planting of the orchard, and I was curious to know if there were any other fruit trees from the days of the ferry operations from the 1920s or earlier. Did any trees survive the period of after the Navajo Bridge went in, the use of the ferry would have dropped, but there still would have been somebody there. So can you pick that up?
I will. I, in thinking about the Lonely Dell and the use there in general, and then especially the orchard and trees, we really, while I was there, there were several long park discussions about whether we should maintain the orchard. One side saying it's not historic, get rid of it. The other side saying that this is an important component of the evolution of the ranch. And so I was involved with a lot of the research. And I was thinking that in the beginning, some of the points that we used to support the orchard was when John D. Lee and his wife Emma arrived in 1872 and built a log cabin near where the ranch is now, next to the Mantis cabin, actually, later. But they had the one cabin. We do know that he planted fruit trees. One of the first things he did, first was to dig the irrigation ditch. Second, he planted fruit trees that he brought with him from Utah.
Okay.
And the way we know this is there's one of the major family legends for the Lee family, which I've heard over and over again, is how, in the beginning, when they were there, John D. Lee was back and forth to Kanab getting more materials and supplies and getting ready to build the ferry and to start a life there being self-sufficient. And one of the trips, he went, everyone went, whoever was there, but left Emma and her baby, her son, alone. And it was definitely going to be a week's trip gone, but in the middle of it, the irrigation ditch went out. She did not really, was not able to restore it to get the water coming down to her log cabin. And the thing that she was the legend was that she was very concerned about this one big peach tree that John D. had planted there and had really emphasized how much it meant to him to, out in this barren desert, if he could get a fruit tree growing, it was a good sign that people could survive there. But she ends up hiking from the cabin to the Korea, which was maybe 200 yards, with a bucket and filling it up from the creek over there, carrying the bucket of water back and pouring it on the peach tree, and making several trips every day to make sure that peach tree survived. And the legend was that it did, and et cetera, et cetera. But it showed one of the examples of her toughness. And she was a very tough woman. So we know there was a peach tree right from the beginning.
Okay.
The earliest photos of the ranch, when the Johnsons were there, it shows north up the Korea, about 100 yards or so north of the Johnson house and the buildings there. There was a fruit orchard, maybe 20, 30 trees.
Okay.
And then the picture also shows a new orchard that was next to it of 30, 40 trees.
Oh, wow.
That were just had planted and were maybe 3 or 4 years old, not really bearing pride yet. But clearly they had trees there. That was in the early 1890s when those pictures are really clear. There's also a picture of one of the workers in the 1890s loading a hay wagon with a huge stack of hay. And in the background are two quite large old apple trees. And then when the weavers took over, there was really not much of, I don't recall any fruit trees. They didn't remain out in those big orchards from the Johnsons. Those did not survive the years. I know Weaver planted almond trees around the ranch house. And people commented about how beautiful it was in the spring, and they got lots of almonds. You asked about any trees that remain. The only one that's documented is next to Samantha's cabin. There's what the park now labels as the Jerry Johnson cabin, which is a smaller log cabin from the 1890s. But next to that is a huge mulberry tree.
Okay.
And it must be, oh, at least 5 feet in diameter.
Oh, wow.
Very gnarled. It's had a rough history. There's great chunks of it have died. Other places have grown out, and it's still a huge, really happy tree. It got the water from the irrigation there, but also apparently got down to the water table because it thrived there. And that we would describe as the only tree. Don't know how old it was. I wish we could have gotten a tree ring analysis, but it would have been difficult because it would have taken several cores to go from the out one side that's growing really well now to the oldest part on the other side that would be have to have its own core, and hoping they match together. But that was never done, but that's the oldest tree.
And mulberries, they produce a edible fruit, and that is typically collected by sweeping the detritus out from under the tree and laying down blankets and catching the fruit as it falls. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
And did you do that? Did anybody do that?
Well, there's another side to the story I found, and that's that there are male and female trees.
Okay.
And also, they're pretty sensitive about when they decide this is going to be a fruiting year.
Okay.
And not going to be.
Right.
Because my first experience was in Page, in our backyard, and we had a large backyard. There was a huge, very old mulberry tree from the Bureau. The first people that lived in our house after it was built in the 1950s, they planted a mulberry tree back there.
Okay.
And it turned out to be female.
Okay.
Which you have for the fruit. And you also need male trees planted around it.
Okay.
Which it turned out our neighbors had.
Okay.
And in fact, but anyway, it was very happy, and every early summer, there was a good 4 weeks, maybe more, that we could not use most of the backyard because the mulberries would come by the bushel.
Wow.
Just piling up on the ground. And I would take a big garbage can with a 50-gallon plastic bag, and with a like a snow shovel, I would shovel these, you know, a whole bag of these that we did not use because, you know, they'd been on the ground, and they also, Page being kind of a lush island in that huge desert up there, it attracts more than a share of songbirds and ravens and all types of migrating birds and birds that stayed there. But that tree was just so noisy with all the birds in it during when the fruit was on that you, another reason you would, didn't want to be out there because it wasn't pleasant. They were all complaining about each other and pretending to, you know, protect their territory. And so there was a lot of bird droppings coming down with the thing. And literally every week I'd have to shovel up the whole can full of maybe 2 to 3 inches of mulberry berries. The rest of the year, it was beautiful. It was a wonderful tree, very shady. But, you know, I had too much of a good thing. I loved the berries, and I would, you know, bring out the ladder, get up in the tree, and just get a few quarts of them to just eat straight. The only problem, they your fingers turn out to be bright purple, your lips turn out to be bright purple, but you can really enjoy it. It's a good fruit. It looks like blackberries, that shape of a fruit. And but anyway, down there, we know it had that one. That tree, really, for the first 10 years I was there, it did not bury. And there was a small tree that one of the maintenance men had planted in front of the Weaver house that they thought was the male tree because that's what they sold in the nurseries. And, in fact, people did not want to buy female trees. But later, one spring, both those trees were just covered with fruit.
Oh, wow.
And they just decided that was the day. And there, I looked around, yeah, there were some other male seedlings coming up that was enough that it got pollinated and what have you. But
okay.
In the years after that, there was quite a bit of mulberries. But I'm sure the pioneers there, all the different families, used that to an extent. You didn't have to work for it. It just...
And I'm assuming that fruit trees need fencing to protect them, to protect the trees from mule deer, mountain sheep, bighorn sheep, or any other type of bovid that might want to get a meal.
Right.
And if that fencing were not maintained, as I'm assuming there was a period of time between the construction of the Navajo Bridge in 28, the opening of the bridge in 29, and the arrival of the weavers in the 30s, maybe a five-year period in there. What do you think? Yeah, I'm just thinking if the fence wasn't maintained, those trees would be fair game.
Well, yeah, the ones up, the old orchards were, decimated. If they're not irrigated constantly, then
the tree
is gone.
That's it. It's not fenced. It's irrigation. I see.
Yeah, and the other thing is when you plant trees down there, and when we planted trees, we got, wire fencing, like a tomato cage with a big one, and then we'd put chicken wire around it, and we really had to because the small trees, the rabbits would get them. Because there were jackrabbits and cottontails all around the ranch there.
And what about beaver?
They would go in and just strip the bark for a foot up the tree.
Okay.
Just as high as they could reach. And they were the main problem with trees dying. You had to make sure that the face that the rabbits couldn't get into them for the first 5 or 6 years, I think. And the story of the trees down there, when Weaver went, he was bankrupt, and one of the ladies that he had loaned money to, one of the visitors, she took over the place in the notes and paid off the notes that he had due, and moved in there for a couple of years at the ranch house with friends, and she was kind of unusual. You have to read about her and T.T. Riley's, but the one thing that I regretted was that she contended that the great-horned owls roosted in the almond trees around the bedroom there, and she had the caretaker go out and cut all the trees down. So we lost all the old almonds there. That's the fact. But the next ones to own it was the Griffin family, and they spent, they were there for many years, from the 1940s to the 60s, well, almost 20 years. And they planted cottonwoods and elm trees around the ranch house there. Did not have many orchard trees that I know of. And they sold out to the consortium of financial people from Phoenix and Mesa, Arizona. And they came up and decided that to purchase this ranch, they had to make money for them. And they used all the big fields were alfalfa and hay and sorghum north of the ranch buildings, and put a pump, or a newer pump up at the Bria River up there that pumped the water into the old historic irrigation ditch. And they wanted to grow grass, and especially like Bermuda grass, for they thought that the being so isolated there, they could get a pure stand of whatever grass they decided to plant without all the weeds coming in and other grasses and hybrids. And so they leveled everything and set it up, and had a couple years that they were growing grass up there for seed. They also decided that they would put in the orchard south of the ranch house. And they put in, it's over 150 fruit trees in the 1960s. And it was irrigated. It had been a field down there all along, so the old irrigation ditch ran up down there.
Okay.
And they set it up where all the trees were irrigated.
Were they all the same type of fruit trees, or did they plant a variety of peaches, apples, and things?
Well, there were basically apricots and peaches.
Okay.
And they were all kind of an Alberta freestone peach. The apricots, I don't recall the variety, but I felt kind of strongly about it because I grew up in apricot orchards, and my uncles were orchardists, and they really instilled in me that the variety that they grew in California and Los Altos Hills there was an older variety, very had small fruit, but bright orange, red, very, very sweet, high sugar. Their competitors were out when, down at Mountain View and Sunnyvale, what's now Silicon Valley, was hundreds and hundreds of orchards down there that planted a new fancy hybrid apricot that had a large fruit, size of a tennis ball, almost just barely yellow on the outside or inside. And to my uncle's dismay, were just basically flavorless.
Yes.
Very typical of what you buy in the supermarket today. And, you know, he really instilled in me the difference. Well, the modern hybridization for large fruit, fruit that can transport easily and get to a supermarket, is not always very good. It doesn't taste. And it's just kind of mushy. So unfortunately, the consortium put in the apricots, the newest super variety, and they're still growing there. And they are big fruit, barely yellow. They're spectacular. When I would eat them, I'd be kind of shake my head that, oh, this is nice, but if I could get, you know, my uncle's real apricots. Well, there was about two partial rows in the middle of the orchard when I was there were old-fashioned apricots.
Oh, wow.
And those were magnificent to me. Everyone else looked at them and said, what's wrong with those little things? But no. And what happened was that the consortium did this for 5 or 6 years, you got the trees producing, and then in 72, they finally convinced the parks to buy the property, because that was their goal for several years, was to hold on to it and make a profit selling it to the park, because the park was all around it.
Right.
And they did. The trees kind of suffered in between there. A lot of them died off, a lot of the peaches especially. I mentioned that Mormon Church and Page came down for a couple of years, tried to keep it going. They put some, planted some, a few trees, but decided it was not going to work for them to get that many people down there that often. An interesting side to it was there are John D. Lee family groups, and they published the newsletters, mimeograph thing that they would send to the park, and they'd send down to me. And I noticed that, well, long before I came in 2000, it would have been, in the 80s maybe, one of the big John D. Lee family groups decided, well, they always were looking for service projects, things to do, and they decided they would replenish the Lonely Dell Orchard. And they, long story short, they got permission and enthusiasm, got a huge group, bought all the trees, and came down and put in, by that time, maybe 100 new trees.
Wow.
On top of maybe the 50 old ones that were still alive. And planted them. It was done really well. They had a variety of trees. And the goal then, for whatever reason, whether it was the park or the group, was to create kind of a big family orchard with lots of different fruit, the kind of fruit that they would have in the old days. So in the 80s, the orchard had plum trees, prunes,
wow.
The two varieties of apricots, some big trees, several varieties of peaches, and I think the idea may have been, one of the excuses may have been, let's try these and see what works. Whatever survives, we'll get more of those. And then, for the next year or two, the park watered them well. They thrived, and then the park didn't water them so well.
Uh-huh.
A lot of them didn't thrive. So, when I got there, Ken Hawkins was working very seriously at keeping what was there. And I think there were probably 50 trees that have died. And the other thing I noticed was that individual visitors that really loved the place or had some family connection or just lived in the Marble Canyon area, they would just come and voluntarily donate a tree, even when I was there. I want to come by. Can we buy a couple fruit trees and bring them up next time we're coming? And I, told them what we wanted. And by then I had found out the apricots we wanted that were thriving. And I'll mention that's the That it was sold throughout Utah from the pioneer days, and it was called either the Manchurian apricot or the Mormon apricot.
Okay.
They were the same trees. The Mormons tended to call them Manchurian apricots. They did come from northern China to California in the gold rush and came back to Utah. And they found that those trees were the most frost hardy, and especially the blossoms when they bloom and when the fruit comes on is critical to where they are. And these were planted throughout southern Utah, and they're still available in nurseries in Utah. So that's what I recommended anyone bring, and they did. And several of those trees are in the middle of the orchard there. And they, as far as, you know, before I left, they were thriving and producing good fruits. So,
you know, it almost seems like the property there, the Lonely Dell, needs a caretaker. It almost needs a full-time dedicated caretaking system where
it definitely does.
People could caretake for some years and then transfer over to someone else.
Yeah. And, you know, develop a caretaking plan. These are the things you need to do in the fall and the spring and the summer. And
work for housing kind of thing. If you know, we'll give you housing and you're going to work there.
Yeah. So
did you talk about that to the Park Service?
Constantly.
Okay.
Constantly. And Sharon and I really didn't want to move down there. Our kids were in school and in college, and we had a nice house up above in Page. And we were, of course, retired and teaching by then, and I knew that I had to retire from the park eventually.
Right.
But I had a few good years in me. And there's always, you know, the whole idea of the apartment at the end of the Weaver Ranch house there was to have a caretaker there.
Okay.
And no one would take the responsibility. Interpretation would have one, but they would have to work at the Navajo Bridge and at the launch ramp and guiding visitors through the ranch. And many of the interpreters I found were very hostile to an interpreter laboring in the field or in the garden.
So that was maintenance. That was a maintenance job. Is that
all we need to do this?
Is that how they saw it? Was that a maintenance job?
No, that would have been, first thing I described would have been an interpretive job.
Right.
Then if you had a maintenance man there, the problem there was convincing them that there was enough work there to do for a maintenance person who wouldn't be, you know, having to spend most of his time out at the campground and the restrooms and up the river and keeping the water plant. And that needed a full-time person, and usually had a full-time person. And they were not receptive to getting a whole new position described and approved for the ranch, which is too bad.
Yeah, because it seems as though a caretaker has to be an interpreter and has to be in maintenance and should know some basic first aid skills and can assist in when law enforcement has to go do a rescue. It can actually help the interpretive rangers can help maintenance, can help law enforcement.
If you have the right people.
If you have the right people with that, those type of generalized skills.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned that the last 3 or 4 years I was down there, I was in resource management, which is another separate division from maintenance and interpretation of rangers. And my job description that they actually got through and were amazed that nobody rebelled was that, in theory, I was all three.
Okay.
20% of my time was going to be interpretation, 20% maintenance, and the 60% resource management, repairing
okay.
the buildings.
All right.
There's still a lot of projects to go. And that's the way my position was advertised. And one of the reasons I got it easily was because there were potentially people from all over the country could have applied for it, but
mm-hmm.
they didn't have the three skills that I could prove that I have and have been using. But we really tried for that. Then the resource managing director said, well, what we really need to do is have interpretation step up and pay 20% of their salary.
Ooh.
And have maintenance step up and pay 20% of his salary. And, you know, they rebelled on that. They said, just forget it. But it was a time, like now, that they're all short of staff.
Right, short staff, short of funding.
Very
yeah.
short of funding. And they said, yeah, this sounds good, but forget about it.
Which is a real shame, because I think a caretaker plan could probably be fairly cost-free, or well, you know, you'd need some funding to make sure they had shovels and, you know, tools and, you know, those types of things. Building maintenance is not cheap.
Yeah.
But you might avoid, you know, basically there would be no salary, it would be a volunteer position.
Okay, that's the next thing I'm going to talk about, because when I had medical issues and stopped, and then came back and was actually working several months from Page from my house, doing the photos and files and making the reports. But there was a friend of ours, Chuck Straub, S-T-R-A-U-B, I guess it is Chuck Straub, and his, well, we knew his, he and his wife, for many years. He was an engineer out at the power plant, the coal-fired power plant out there.
Yep.
And was getting near retirement. He had two children that were college and out of college, and the daughter was getting ready to get married, and fortunately not a, you know, next month, but next year. And she had this one request, and that she could get married at Lonelydale Ranch, period. And he called me and says, you know, I've been down there, and since you've been gone, things are pretty scrusty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing around the ranch there has really been cared for, other than some watering now and then. And I hate to tell my daughter that she can't be married there. And I said, well, in fact, she came over to our place and we talked about it at length. And I just said, I can't go down there and work on it. I'm not rehabbed enough to do that. And he understood, and he asked me what needed to be done, And we talked about that at great length. And he went to the park, to my boss at the resource management, and said, the story is very straightforward. My daughter wants to get married. I'm willing to fix up the ranch so we can have her wedding there. And they said, well, okay. And he went down there for months and ended up just absolutely loving the place.
He
got the area around the Weaver Ranch house, and she was married between there and with the background of the orchard. He cleared out all the weeds in the orchard and just decided, you know, well, he knew very strongly why they had to have a caretaker there, because he was doing it and he wasn't getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just because he wanted to. And after the wedding, he just kind of said, I can't leave it. I got to go back. So for the last several years, he has volunteered, and he goes sometimes once a couple, every few weeks, or he goes down and goes down every day for several weeks. And he has spearheaded the pruning the orchard with all the help he can get, but knowing that in the end, like me, I got lots of help, but in the end, I had to prune the last whole bunch of trees to get them ready in time.
Mm.
And he pruned them. He was there long enough that the new maintenance guy let him turn the water into the orchard from the water plant. And he then got groups that would donate a few trees, and they'd go down and plant them and put the fencing around every one of them. And he put in, or facilitated putting in another 30 or 40 trees down there to replace the ones that had died in the meantime.
Okay.
And he would mow the grass in front of the ranch house. And I don't think he really did any historic renovations of the buildings. I think he helped clean up the Samantha's cabin. And I know that now, when all is said and done, his daughter decided to become an interpretive park ranger.
Hmm.
And her first job was at Page, and she really demanded that she go to Lee Ferry.
Oh, wow.
So she went out of her way to have interpretive programs there. You know, they'd have a special day and advertise it. And
nice.
People would come, and it was really good in all ways. And they've had crews that have come down and worked a little more on the ranch house. I think they've improved the foundation under the apartment. And then they just kind of, all the interpreters and friends and Chuck and his friends and would come, and they probably, under Berger direction now, would have fixed up the apartment. But I don't think they've got permission yet to have anyone live there.
Okay.
It's close, but and it depends so much on the individual.
Yes.
Because there can be a time, and I believe she has gone on to another park somewhere.
OK. Okay.
So that's, I'm not sure of that, because I don't have contact with her. But, you know, it's a wonderful place. It needs, you know, what we always said, we meaning resource management, the historic district, that it could stand on its own as a national monument.
Oh, wow.
A historic national monument. There's enough history there, there's enough buildings, there's to compare to any of the historic monuments that are around the Southwest. But that's never going to happen.
Right. I mean, it is part of Glen Canyon Natural Recreation Area.
It would better served under Grand Canyon, but that was something I never said because it would aggravate people and praise you even more.
How do you mean it would be better under Grand Canyon? Because when I look at the map, wasn't Lonely Dell, when it was sold to the Park Service, didn't it become part of the recreation area?
Yeah, it is part of the recreation area.
Okay.
But, you know, there could be modifications of the, if there was enough support for it, it could happen. But to me, if you look at the map, it's a, from the south rim, the maintenance crews would go to the north rim.
Oh.
And back and forth. They all cross Navajo Bridge.
Right.
Now, so that they're 5 miles from there.
Yeah.
There
hmm.
could be a maintenance person from south rim could definitely hook up with all the maintenance and interpretation, everything from the south rim. Red and Page, it's a 45 miles to the bridge every day and another 5 out to the ranch. So,
right.
You know, I had almost 100 miles a day that I commuted 2 hours a day.
Wow.
To get back every day, day in and day out, and week in and week out for several years.
It's funny. It's a place that needs attention, and the places that can give it attention are far away on the North Rim, the South Rim, and Page. You know, those organizational headquarters are far away.
Right.
Mm.
Right.
Wow.
So, you know, that's, I'm sure the story's not over.
Right.
For Lee's Ferry and the historic park. And I wish that every little thing that they do for rehab and all, every little bit adds up and gets better. But I know full well that when you on the other side, those buildings are taking a step back every year, that they're not actively maintained, and we'll be back to, you know, every 10 years or so. Oh, you know, there's people all so surprised that, my goodness, that collapsed.
Right, know? Right.
No one noticed.
Alan,
no one was there, and no one was responsible.
Do you have thoughts on this? It's almost like a boom and bust. I mean, we go through our lives, and you know, you've dedicated your life to the Park Service and to education, and eventually, you know, we become older, and you know, disease crops in, cancer, and whatever. It seems as though the structures that Park Service is trying to preserve are timeless, meaning they go on and they last generations through generations. Do you have any thoughts for managers about how best to care for these places through the generations?
Well, the only thing is very simple, what we just discussed. You have to have staff dedicated to being there continuously. They need to be assigned there, not somewhere else and occasionally coming down, because it's just an ongoing thing, and I think there's enough maintenance or resource management is the best way to discuss the buildings.
Yep.
But they need to have someone who's dedicated to those places. Resource management in Glen Canyon has all these Pueblo ruins and sites that they have to manage and make sure don't collapse and aren't destroyed and protected. And this historic stuff, it seems, well, it's part of the same thing. They've got to be protected and taken care of and constantly. And I'll tell you, every one of the crew people that would come out to restore the buildings, and there were at least six or eight crews that came for several weeks doing projects to try and save those buildings. But every one of them would tell me, that they were so happy to see me there doing what I was doing, because they don't see that in other parks.
Right.
They go and restore a building and go away, and the park locks the door, and there's no follow-up. And not because of that they don't want to, it's just they have so much, park people have so much other things to deal with that they just don't get around to it. The way to protect them is to have someone on site, no matter how they are funded or what group they're with. Right now, I think, or when I was back in Page, it's still resource management division. If they could get funding for a new position and down there, they would go for it. But there is no funding.
Right.
And they had the huge issue on the polluted water and Lake Powell, which took had a large staff to get that under control, and that was all resource management. And then the Quagga Mussels, that program was under resource management and had, a large staff.
Right.
And when you ask, could we have someone at least very, they just kind of, especially at the meetings where the other groups would list all the people they need for the Quagga Mussel and the water quality and the archaeology, and then the last ones is, oh, we need somebody at Lee's Ferry, and it's like, no, you're on the list, but you're at the end of the list.
Right. That's why I can't help but think the concept of a caretaking plan could answer that funding, because granted, the needs of the recreation area are huge, are almost overwhelming, if not overwhelming.
Yeah.
So in order to make that happen, because I think there's funding, there is funding to help with the maintenance backlog. There's not funding to help with salaries and hiring people.
Right.
So
all has to be contracted out to outside groups that can be excellent. If they come in and, they do the project and go back and have nothing to do with our maintenance people.
Right.
Other than me, indirectly, but that's, the real problem.
Right. So that's why maybe a caretaking plan could answer that.
Yeah. Right.
With no salary, but a place to stay and much to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you could find somebody, In fact, if you do find somebody, let me know, and or you tell them to contact there, because I know right now if someone had a travel trailer, they could get three sites up at the campground, and they can, for as long as they'll volunteer. But you need someone who can do, you know, more than clean up trash and clean the restrooms and talk to people. We're talking about someone that knows about houses and renovating. And,
right. You clearly have to have a diverse range of skills, which would be in much demand.
I hate to even think about it, but this might be a good place to end our
I think so too, Alan. I want to thank you for your service to our federal lands and to educating our future generations. This has been one of the best oral history interviews I have ever done. I really appreciate your taking the time to do this. It's absolutely been lovely.
I appreciate it too, and I keep reminding myself that, you know, what you said at the beginning was basically what you wanted was get my reminiscences and remembrances of the early Grand Canyon and the Western Canyon and what I did there. And then, you know, it developed into at Page as a teacher and taking guiding trips all over the area and into the canyon for the college, and then the years working for Glen Canyon and down at Lee's Ferry. And I know that I didn't come anywhere near telling the history of Glen Canyon or the history of Glen Canyon. It's just things that I remembered and I thought about. Someone else that experienced the same things would have remembered other things and had different attitudes toward it. So I ended up feeling very good about sharing these remembrances. That's it. And I can see where there are a lot of people, pioneers in many ways, that you wish have left some kind of a written or oral record. You know, a lot of questions. I know the guy that I was so close to, Owen Johnson and Marcuson, who was born and raised in Samantha's cabin. When I got to Lee's Ferry, I just, it was barely a day that I didn't think, boy, I wish he was still there, you know, that he had passed on. And I realized, well, I didn't ask him about this, and I really would love to ask him about that.
Yep.
And there were just hundreds of things that I'd come upon on the ranch there that he could have told me, but I didn't ask him. He didn't bring it up. So that's why, you know, what we've done, I've enjoyed, and I don't think it's any earth-shaking, but it's, I just might be interesting to somebody.
I'm sure it will be.
Because I never would have gone into this if you hadn't twisted my arm.
Well, I'm very grateful for you for doing this. I'm thrilled that we've done it. And on behalf of the Grand Canyon Historical Society, thank you so much for doing this. And I look forward to visiting with you down the road.
Good enough. Thank you, John.
Okay, thanks, Alan. This will conclude part 23 of 23 of a Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is Wednesday, August 30th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and once again, thank you so much, Alan.
Thank you again.